Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Whenever I am part of a retreat like this, with a defined beginning and end, I always feel as a sense of community, you know, as the retreat all comes together and then gets underway. It feels like we're all climbing on board the ship and setting off on the journey. And then as the retreat comes to its end, then there's this feeling of the ship coming into port. You can see the shoreline up ahead and the prospect of the journey coming to a finish is getting closer and closer. So we've been together for a few days now. This is Friday evening. We gathered together on Monday evening. So again, even though we've only been together for 4 days. It feels like forever. And also just the idea of us not being together as a group also seems like, what? No! But we belong together, yeah? So these are our feelings and perceptions. And even though retreat times have their difficulties and struggles, they also have their many blessings and qualities that are very precious, very beautiful, important for us. And the one of the main questions that comes into people's minds as the ship is heading back towards the port is how do I carry on this journey? How do I continue in the same spirit when I'm back in that other world? I won't say the real world, but the other world. Yeah. Well, hopefully some of the things that I've said in these last few days are things that we can naturally take with us and apply, and maybe it's been possible to see how there's a lot of dimensions to the practice of Dhamma that don't require a peaceful and contained, systematically controlled environment. Spoken about things like having radical acceptance for the experience of each moment. Spoken about decision making, mindful decision making, and such. So, in the course of our everyday lives, and you're dealing with your family, your workplace, dealing with the other members of the traffic on the roads, then these are all elements that are part of it. There are, however, a few particular methods or techniques that it's useful to emphasize or to clarify, little practices that we can do that help to sustain a quality of clarity when the objects get much more complicated, when the rest of the people around you are not following your Dharma routine. They are running on different value systems, different calendars, different clocks. They have different sets of priorities. And in this country where you have very different populations interacting, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, the Christian community, yeah, everyone's got their own Sabbath day, you know. Is the holy day Friday or Saturday or Sunday? Or if you're Buddhist, it's on the moon day, you know, and the moon keeps moving, you know. So, in the midst of movement, it's very easy for our attention to be caught into what we call becoming, bhava tanha. We get busy with the thing that we're doing. We have a routine. We get up in the morning, we make our breakfast, we deal with the family and get ready for work and get on the bus or get in our car. And we have, during the course of the day, you know, 100, 1,000 different little routines and habits that we follow. And even though these might seem ordinary everyday functions, often we're in those ordinary everyday situations where we're feeding habits of identification, you know, habits of attachment that we don't even realize that they're there. So one of the practices that I like to encourage is what I call micro meditations. A few of you were with me for the city retreat that we had in Tel Aviv last week, and I was talking about that there, and perhaps a few of you have tried putting those into practice. So that what I mean by micro meditation is where in the normal flow of your day, just say when you are... You come into, say, maybe you work in a company, you have an office. So rather than just walking through the door of your office, sitting yourself down at the desk, clicking on the computer, and then immediately just getting launched into your 101 emails, so sit down, you know, come through the door, sit down at your desk, and don't turn on your computer for 5 seconds. So when I say micro, I really mean micro, you know. And now it's very interesting how you might feel like 45 minutes is a long time. But when things are very active and busy, when you come striding into your office, you plunk yourself down in the seat and then you stop. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Even 5 seconds is a long time. And this doesn't just work when you come into your office, coming into your kitchen. Yeah, maybe you're up early in the morning before the rest of the household, stumble into the kitchen before you turn on the kettle to make your tea. Just go into the kitchen and don't turn on the kettle. Just stop. 1, 2, 3. Then turn on the kettle. And what is surprising, and most people find, is that when we just take these moments to pause, we notice the at that point the intense flow of becoming that we are familiar with. We're so accustomed. We're so habituated to a particular routine, sets of actions, we don't even notice where we are. We don't notice what's going on. We don't notice the things that we're being occupied by. So in a way, this is picking up on the third noble truth I was speaking about the other day. So dukkha nirodha needs to be realized. Satchikata Bhante. that ending of dukkha needs to be realized, to notice space. Now, the space in your kitchen sits there all night long without you in it. It's just happily sitting there being space. Your office, in the office building, unless there's somebody on a night shift, it sits there just being silent, spacious, and still. And that silence and spaciousness and stillness is there, even in the midst of the day. But we don't notice it because we're so busy with our list of things to do. So a way of reconfiguring, reshaping the way we relate to our work, our family, the spaces we live in, is something that we can do. We can reshape that. We can revision the way we relate to our family, our work, our life, our world, through a simple little method like this. And I developed this as a practice myself. And years ago, I lived at Amravati Monastery between 85 and 95. And during that time, I had many different roles. I was sometimes the guest monk, sometimes the work monk, sometimes the monastery. I was a monastery secretary for a long time. And in that era, the buildings at Amravati, they were originally constructed as a summer camp. So they were just wooden huts, like in an army camp, uninsulated, built in 1939. So they were old sort of summer camp scout huts. And so when we moved in there, we didn't have any money to redevelop the site in any big way, but we decided to fix up the buildings as best we could. So we took all the walls off, building by building, made them a little bit wider, so from 10 centimeters to 15 centimeters, filled them with insulation, and then put all the planks back on the outside again for about, 22 buildings. If you add it all up, there's about 5 kilometers of planking. On the outside of the buildings, and 1 kilometer, a meter wide. So there's a lot of walls and a lot of insulation. And so this project that went on for a long, long time, and helping to look after the work crews and all the resident monks and nuns and guests. So it will be very busy, a lot of activity and dust and noise and saws going and hammering. And so what I would do would be if we were working on a particular building, then after the morning meditation, I would go to the building where we were working, the work site, and I just, before anybody else showed up, I just go and sit on a pile of wood or some of the bales of insulation. And just sit down, not doing anything, not meditating, but just sit there and just say to myself, the work site. Here it is. This is the work site. And just let that feeling of stillness, silence, space really soak in. Just be there for 5 minutes before getting on with the day. And then, as the work routine began, half an hour or an hour later, then even as a lot of stuff and noise, activity and things going on, something underneath it all remembers the silence before it all began, the stillness that's there behind all the movement. And then I do it similarly at the end of the day, often after the evening meditation. Rather than just going straight back to my room, I'd go back to the work site, and then not to assess all the work that was done during the day, but just to, again, go back to the place of stillness, okay? It's the work site. So then, by framing the day in that way, or the framing that activity, then you'd find that even while all the activity was going on, part of you would remember, oh yeah, underneath this all, behind all the noise and activity and the flurry, the same quality of stillness and presence. It's always here. It never goes anywhere. Works very well with meeting rooms, board rooms. It's fantastic. Go to the meeting room, and 10 minutes before the meeting begins, sit down at the table. You know what's on the agenda. So without thinking about things that you've got to do, just go there. Feel the space. Let yourself be fully conscious of what's present. The feeling of that moment. And then people start coming, and then the meeting begins, and you know, all the conversation and opinions and feelings and decisions. And then, again, even in the midst of all that conversation, then something is remembering that the underpinning, the ground of stillness. So, you know, you can apply these in your own ways throughout your day. Also, sitting down in your car, if you drive a car, it's a great practice. Open the door, get in the car, sit behind the wheel, don't turn it on. Just let your, why is your driving seat any different from your meditation seat? Still sitting, you can just sit there and just be conscious of car. Here it is, the car. The living room. The bathroom. Very handy. You're always alone. No one's going to walk in. So just to create little pauses, little stopping points during the course of the day. And in that you are able to recollect. Oh yes, there is stillness, there's silence, there's spaciousness that underlies this whole flow of experience. So in this way, we're recollecting the stillness along with all the flowing, because our conditioning is all about getting absorbed into the flow. So this is, in a way, consciously recollecting the stillness that's there with the flow to balance things out. So it can be surprising just how long, 5 seconds, particularly if you're really in a hurry, you got really important things to do, there's a serious meeting, 5 seconds is a really long time. But still, I can guarantee that every single person in this room can find an extra 5 seconds in the day, here and there. None of us are that busy. Even if you're the Prime Minister, you know, probably not here on this retreat, but probably got a few heads of hospitals and schools and corporations of various kinds. So that is a very helpful method to apply. Also, because we tend to so easily live in our heads, in our thoughts, our lists of things to do, our plans and our conceptual proliferations, to balance out that preoccupation with the thinking world, to set the intention at the beginning of the day to use mindfulness of the body. The body is always in the present moment. You might have noticed. Your thoughts might imagine the past and the future, right? But your body is the most faithful friend. No matter how far you drift off, when you come back, it's always there. Right? Has anybody had that compelling, a fantasy that was so compelling, you got so absorbed that when you came back, your body had vanished? Yeah, I've had some pretty serious fantasies, but, you know, he's always here to come back to, like the most faithful friend. The body is your guaranteed anchor in the present moment. It's always here, it's always in the present. So, if we want to help the attention to stay with the present, then the most obvious way of doing that is to focus on the body. And whereas our thoughts can get very intricate and complicated and emotionally charged, you know, the body's language is very simple and straightforward. Left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. Ouch. Ooh, that's nice. Yeah. Hot. Cold. Yeah, it's a very simple, straightforward earthy language. So, it helps to set an intention at the beginning of a day to say, to make a clear, conscious effort. Okay, during today, I will make the effort, have the intention to bring attention to the body. And you know, nowadays, everybody has watches with bleepers on or iPhones that will give you little signals, special little ringtones that say, pay attention to your body now. Yeah. I'm sure there's an app for it. Really, I was in the hospital visiting somebody a month or two ago, and I met this woman in the elevator. She was in a wheelchair, and she said, "Oh, what are you?" I said, "Well, I'm a person. What are you? You know?" No. What? I mean, why are you dressed like that? I said, "Well, I'm a Buddhist monk." "Oh, Buddhist monk! I've got an app for that." She said, and I kind of looked at her, I thought, you what? She said, yeah, I've got a Buddha app. Look. Yeah. And she did. You know, she had this little Buddha app on her iPhone. So this has made her day, meeting this monk in the elevator. So, and it was quite marvelous. And she had it was her way of keeping track of her feelings and, how she always get distracted by things, and she's got this Buddha app that keeps her on track, helps her to remember to notice the feelings that she's having and to pay attention to what she's doing, what's going on. But you don't need one of those. the internal app is far more useful. And setting that in the beginning of the day so that you're making a recollection, an intention. Okay, during the course of the day, you know, every so often, notice the body. How am I feeling? What are the sensations of the body? Again, when you're sitting on the bus or sitting in a meeting, you know, you're working in the garden, looking after the family, you know, playing with the kids, digging in your farm, whatever it might be, this to notice, how am I holding the body? You know, what am I doing? What are the feelings of tension or relaxation? What's happening here? And over, as you will have noticed during this week, as we've been together, how often we get wrapped up in our mental world and we're very excited by something or we're angry about something or we're worried about something. And when we bring the attention into the body, we notice, oh, that this worry is takes shape as a knot of tightness in my belly. Or this angry feeling, it's like a steel bar across my shoulders. Or this feeling of desire, this sexual fantasy is like a, you know, tightening in my lungs and my throat. Then we notice that feeling, and then we let the body relax, and then, oh, there's no support for that anxiety. That angry feeling is no longer being fed by that tension being sustained. Aha! So, consciously developing that mindfulness of the body is an extraordinarily helpful way of keeping our system balanced, and to notice when the mind is getting wrapped up in particular, you know, emotional states and preoccupations. Bringing attention to the body, noticing where those stresses and tensions are being created, and then training yourself to consciously relax, to let the body, in a way, bringing loving kindness into the body. Another way also, as we've been talking about during this week, came up in the question answer session today about, emotional states. And, there was a question about, getting a sense for that distancing or that abstracting of the watcher or the witness. I was saying, okay, just to name what's going on. Okay, here's the feeling of me watching that. Here's the witness knowing that object. So just to name what the emotional state is. Like, here is the I'm waiting for the bus and I'm wondering whether it's going to come feeling. Here is the, oh no, it's that meeting and I'm not prepared feeling. Here is that, whoopee, I'm home and at last I can spend some time with my kids feeling. So a simple naming of what is present doesn't mean that we're shutting down the feeling or trying to suppress it or get rid of it, but just noticing, you know, what's here. And I find this, it's a very simple but an extraordinarily helpful practice. This is the whoopee, I got what I wanted feeling. Or this is the oh no, I really didn't want this to happen feeling. And it's amazing, at least to me, how regularly the mind has absorbed into a hope, into a fear, into something to be excited about, fascinated with, annoyed with, complaining about. And we don't notice that the mind is complaining. We believe our judgments. We believe that person is wrong. They shouldn't be that way. Or we believe that person is really interesting and inspiring. We take that to be absolutely true. We say, oh, this food is great. This is delicious. Or this is really awful. And if we just take a moment applying mindfulness in this way to recognize, oh, this food is awful feeling, then it still tastes that way, but you're not swept up. The heart is not carried away by that. Or someone is really interesting or inspiring. That, oh, this is the, I'm really glad to meet that person feeling. How wonderful this moment is feeling. Now you might feel this is like sterilizing your emotions, but my experience of it is rather than sterilizing, it's more like liberating our emotions so that you're not only you're able to feel enthusiasm and excitement and happiness without getting drunk on it or caught up in obsessive chasing after it, you can actually enjoy it. Because you're not grasping it. As William Blake put it in one of his poems, and you have to excuse the gender-specific language. This is 18th century England. He that binds himself to a joy doth the winged life destroy. You grasp hold of a joy, own it, claim it, then that's what suffocates, that destroys that joyfulness. He that binds himself to a joy doth the winged life destroy. He that kisseth a joy as it flies, when you kiss a joy as it flies, lives in eternity's sunrise. So this is how, you know, it's a kind of California Dharma. But kissing the joy as it flies, even though it was William Blake who was, you know, English and a couple of hundred years ago, kissing the joy as it flies is what we're learning how to do. Similarly, when something's really painful and difficult, I don't know about you, but I always get, you know, tense and you're trying to fix it and get away from it or do something with it. Like, oh no, this is, what am I going to do? Oh, she's really upset and it's my, you know, responsibility. I've got to. And then to be able to recognize, oh, this is awkward feeling. This is the, oh dear, this person's really upset and they're expecting me to fix them feeling. That's what this is. Then in that moment, there's a little bit more space. And probably that some of you who are therapists probably have specific training in how not to get drawn into identifying with people's moods. This is a really excellent and simple direct way of doing that, of learning how to empathize with others and with a situation, but not get entangled in it, not get caught up or like I was saying earlier, I tend to be a compulsive fixer. And to just be able to recognize this is the, oh dear, this person's really suffering a lot. I wonder what I can do to help them. And I'm not quite sure how to answer their question. Feeling. That's what this is. And then just having that little bit of extra space, there's a, oh. And then your own intuitive wisdom can function much more freely. Now, freeing the heart from those compulsions is a lot of what Dharma practice is about. In the, I haven't talked about it this week. We've only had, you know, 4 days together so far, and I've covered a lot of teachings, but one of the areas I haven't specifically spoken about is what's called dependent origination. Probably familiar territory to some, to many of you. This is a process of cause and effect that the Buddha described numerous times. And it defines the relationship between ignorance, desire, and suffering. Some of you can also relate it to the first book of Genesis, the creation of the world, then desire in the garden, and then Adam and Eve experiencing dukkha. Or you can not bother with that if you don't like. But there's and this is a very, very common format for teaching meditation. And in the classical expression of dependent origination in relationship to Dharma practice, the key point is the connection between feeling and desire. It describes how with the basic arising of experience and then the feeling of subject and object that formulates into the sense of me experiencing the sense world and the feelings of pleasure and pain that come from that. So there's a bridge that's then crossed between feeling and desire. And as when the mind is attentive simply to the realm of feeling, then we can be aware of liking, disliking, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And there can still be plenty of clarity and spaciousness around that. As soon as the mind crosses that bridge and then gets drawn into desire, like, I hate, I can't stand, I've got to get away from this, I can't bear it, or I want it, I got to have it, I can't live without it, then the world shrinks. The universe shrinks to that desire object, that thing I can't stand. Like, you might have noticed how when you're physically comfortable, and you're sitting here, and then you're working with the meditation, you're hearing sounds around you, you're noticing different variety of perceptions and feelings, and then you get an ache or pain in your knee, and then everybody else in the room vanishes, all the noises disappear, and all there is, the universe has shrunk to that one spot in your knee. So this is all, I'm sure, a well-known territory for many of us here. So that bridge between feeling and desire, it's extraordinarily helpful to bring attention to that and to train ourselves to not cross the bridge. the sequence of cause and effect that then comes after feeling conditions desire, craving, tanha, then craving conditions grasping conditions becoming, and becoming conditions birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Soka parideva dukkha domanasa upayasa. If you want to write that down. No. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So it's like getting onto a train. When we are just able to experience the realm of feeling, it's like you're standing on the platform and the train comes into the station and you ask yourself, do I want to get onto this train? you recognize you don't need to climb aboard. Following that feeling of letting it to turn into craving, and craving into grasping, grasping into becoming, that's like getting onto the train. The train takes off and then slowly speeds up. So while it's still at the level of craving, the train is not moving very quickly. So you can get off, but you might have to run a bit down the platform. By the time it's turned into grasping, you've really held on to that feeling or that desire, then the train's getting a bit faster, and if you jump off, it's going to really hurt. By the time it's off to becoming and birth, then it's going to be a real mess if you if you leave the train at that point. So that in terms of our mindfulness of everyday life, learning to recognize the feelings of dislike, like I really don't want this. I can't stand the feeling of I can't stand this. To know this is a feeling. That's what this feeling is. Or a feeling of desire. I really want this. I like this. I really like this. To be able to establish and clarify that emotional pull of this is liking. That's what this is. And to realize we have a choice. We don't have to get on that train. We don't have to cross that bridge. Yeah, a story I've often told is one that Ajahn Sumedho recounted that of an exchange he had with Ajahn Chah when he was a young monk. You might think that life here at Indore on this retreat is austere and difficult, but Wat Bapa Ajahn Chah's monastery back in the 60s was seriously plain. It was, one meal a day, and Ajahn Chah, as I think I mentioned the other day, was proud of the fact that Wat Bapong had the worst food in the world. And when the cooks improved it, he would go and scold them and say, "No, you gotta damp it down. This is getting too delicious." He wanted to sustain the reputation of the awful food. And, you get the morning bell would get up at three, it would be at 3 o'clock in the morning. You'd meet at 3:30 for the morning chanting meditation. One meal a day meant one meal a day. And you might get a cup of tea once a week. Once every couple of weeks. And so it was pretty plain, pretty rough and demanding. And so, and there wasn't a lot of stimulation of any kind of sense contact. It was just, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, you could spend hours just watching the lizards walking around on the wall of your kuti just for some entertainment. So anyway, on this particular occasion, there's a nursing college, in Ubon, in the nearby town. And once a year, the teachers of the college would bring the nursing students into the monastery to have some Dhamma instruction from Ajahn Chah. And so this was in the early days of Ajahn Sumedho being there, and a foreign monk was a very, very rare commodity. He was a kind of legendary figure that there, is it true there's this American monk, this big white guy? Because most people have never even seen a foreigner apart from the American soldiers at the airbase. So Ajahn Chah usually would leave Ajahn Sumedho to be by himself, but occasionally he'd bring him out so that people could actually meet this legendary white monk. And to see that, it's true, this person had given up a comfortable life in the West to come and live at Wat Bapong and to train in a Dhamma practice. So on that occasion, Ajahn Chah had the young Ajahn Sumedho sitting with him, and there's a whole group of these young nursing students, so like 50, 80 young teenage girls in the smart nurses' uniforms and the instructors with them. And so in that kind of environment, as a monk, you were generally not around many, many members of the opposite sex, and certainly that young and all kind of keenly paying attention and nearby. And so, and in Northeast Thailand, they have a very, very straightforward culture in terms of talking about things like food, sex, death, body functions. It's very, very sort of natural, ordinary, everyday, matters of discussion, but very non-English. We never talk about anything like that. And anyway, at the end, after this group had been there and visiting for a couple of hours, and they paid their respects and they left, and Ajahn Chah turned to the young Ajahn Sumedho and said, "So Sumedho, what did that do to your mind? Having all these, 70 or 80 attractive young women just sort of sticking right up close to you. You know, what did that do to your mind? And then what Ajahn Sumedho said was, I like, but I don't want. And Ajahn Chah was so impressed with that. He then, apparently for the next 2 or 3 weeks, every Dhamma talk he gave was on that theme of like how, you know, even Sumedho has only been a monk for a couple of years and already he understands this. This is, because that's, it's really important to acknowledge that, yeah, there's an impact. There's a, you know, the senses work, the hormones are doing their thing. Yeah, there's liking, you know, that effect can happen. But you don't have to do anything with it. You don't have to suppress it. You don't have to hate yourself for it. You don't have to follow it. You don't have to make any kind of a story out of it. And so Ajahn Chah felt this was a really, really skillful way of expressing it. And so took that as a theme. So that's a very helpful little nugget, again, for us to remember, I like, but I don't want. But if you find that your feet, even as your brain is saying, I like, but I don't want, that your feet have already crossed that bridge, you say, well, I told myself I didn't want, but how come I'm suddenly here in the shop, you know, and there's this cookie in my hand, you know. How did that happen? You know, like, oh, look, there's an empty bag. Where did they go, you know? I wasn't going to go into the bakery, and now, what happened there? But, you know, even if we've already crossed the bridge and gone a few miles down the road, still we can use that our reflective faculty to look and to look at our habits and say, okay, well, that's interesting. I had this resolution not to do that, and so I didn't manage to stick with that. Now, what does this feel like now, having followed that desire? Having gone into the bakery and filled myself with cookies, and what's the result of that? So again, not creating a negative self-view or self-criticism, just to say, okay, what's come from that? How do I feel now? What's the effect of that action? So yeah, well, I feel pretty awful actually. A sense of regret that I didn't follow that principle, but also like, yeah, I really didn't need those. And so you're just letting the natural effects of your actions then be what teach you, rather than the superego saying you shouldn't do this or you should do that, but more it's our own natural experience is what guides us. Now, I could probably sit here most of the night giving you a long list of these useful tips, but it's now 9:15 already, and we've still got some time together tomorrow morning, so I'll have a few more of these kind of reflections and suggestions, but I think this is enough to digest for the evening, so I'll offer these thoughts for reflection. Let us close with, speaking of good advice for living in the world, let us close with the discourse on the highest blessings, the Mangala Sutta, if we can have some light. Page 40.
Thus have I heard that the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi, residing at the Jetas Grove. Then in the dark of the night, a radiant Deva illuminated all Jetas Grove. She bowed down low before the Blessed One. Then standing to one side, she said, Devas are concerned for happiness and ever long for peace. The same is true for humankind. What then are the highest blessings? Avoiding those of foolish ways, associating with the wise, and honoring those worthy of honor. These are the highest blessings, living in places of suitable kinds, with the fruits of past good deeds, and guided by the rightful way. These are the highest blessings, accomplished in learning and craftsman skills, with discipline highly trained, and speech that is true and pleasant to hear. These are the highest blessings, providing for mother and father's support, and cherishing family, and ways of work that harm no being. These are the highest blessings, giving with Dhamma in the heart, offering help to relatives and kin, and acting in ways that meet no blame. These are the highest blessings, steadfast in restraint, and shunning evil ways, avoiding intoxicants that dull the mind, and heedfulness in all things that arise. These are the highest blessings, respectfulness and being of humble ways, contentment and gratitude, and hearing the Dhamma frequently taught. These are the highest blessings, patience and willingness to accept one's faults, seeing venerated seekers of the truth, and sharing often the words of Dhamma. These are the highest blessings, the holy life lived with ardent effort, seeing for oneself the noble truths, and the realization of Nibbana. These are the highest blessings, although involved in worldly ways, unshaken the mind remains, and beyond all sorrow, spotless secure. These are the highest blessings, they who live by following this path, know victory wherever they go, and every place for them is safe. These are the highest blessings.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā. The Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi. I render homage to the Buddha, the blessed one. So akato bhagavata dhammo, the teaching so completely explained by him. Tammaṃ namassāmi, I bow to the Dhamma. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho, the blessed ones, disciples who have practiced well, saṅghaṃ namāmi, I bow to the Sangha.